Now, the controversy over Raymond McCreesh and allegations that he wanted to come off the hunger strike and was dissuaded from so doing by his family. We'll come to those precisely in a moment. But recalling the period, Eamon, there were a number of stories being put about that the prisoners were, in fact, secretly eating and drinking.
Yeah, and I remember, I received some of these stories, Pat, actually. They were imparted to me, and they were coming via the NIO, and the NIO were using the British press to put these stories around. But after the hunger strike, and when I was researching, I met a doctor who violated, actually, the Official Secrets Act, because if his identity had become known, he would have been in big trouble. But he told me, I have a very specific record, 294 of the book, The IRA. He said, for the first 6 weeks, now he was dealing directly with the prisoners, so he saw the deterioration in the condition from A to Z. For the first 6 weeks, they vomited repeatedly. Then at about 45 days stage, the doctors noticed a remarkable improvement. The retching stopped. The hunger strikers were able to hold down fluids. As a result, they seemed more lucid and demonstrated signs of recovery. This phenomenon aroused suspicion. There were stories out outside the jail that the prisoners were secretly taking vitamins. The medical staff even took away some samples of the tissues that the men used to moisten their lips. They found nothing. So you can see the context in which the word got out that there's something going on here.
And
some of
the
these
British
guys aren't determined to go through.
Should have had experience of hunger strikers and the course of a hunger strike from their own histories.
Well, I don't know how expansive that would be, but I don't think to this day the medical records of this period have ever been revealed. Now, I certainly, maybe Eamon Phoenix is an historian, has had access to, but this has been, I think this has been locked away because they didn't want aping and mocking and mimicking and other prisoners coming along gaining experience, I suspect, from the medical records. Now, if anyone can contradict me, I'm prepared to.
We'll go to Eamon Phoenix on this one. What the estate papers actually say about the McCreesh family?
Well, it's a very poignant file, but it's very much disputed by the family. Father Brian McCreesh has issued several statements, not only repudiating it, but he says he has his own account of the events of that long weekend in mid-May 1981, when, according to the authorities, Raymond McCreesh was prepared to accept medical intervention and indeed nutrients. Basically, the file contains two written statements, one by a prison kind of officer and one by a medical orderly, to the effect that during that day, the 16th of May 1981, Raymond McCreesh was asked, "Do you want us to save your life?" Now, they admit he was in a disorientated state. And the answer was affirmative. They asked him, "Did he want milk?" And he said he would wait for his family to arrive. They then report the family arrived and had a meeting with their dying son and relative, in sight, out of hearing. The problem, according to these files, was that Raymond McCreesh was weak, his hearing was failing, and so voices were raised. And then there is, in both of these signed accounts, claims that Raymond McCreesh seemed to be confused. He thought he was in a hospital in Scotland. He was told he was in a British concentration camp. And then his brother, allegedly, was heard to say, "You have to be strong, like your comrade Patsy O'Hara." And then his mother allegedly said, I was overheard saying by these two sources, "Now, Raymond, you're going back on your word." Now, what I didn't realise until this week in the McCreesh family intervention was that all of this appeared in the Sunday Times at that time in 1981, and Eamon Malley will be aware of that, and these were refuted at the time by the family. But certainly the family feel there was some attempt to hypnotise or intervene in some way in Raymond McCreesh's case. Obviously, we can't verify that. We simply have these two statements, which were meticulously written in longhand and then typed up, and of course Raymond McCreesh was to die less than 10 days later, along with Patsy O'Hara, the third and fourth hunger strikers to die.
Pat, can I just add something to that? Because I was around at the time and spoke to the McCreesh family and was aware that this story had been leaked by either the prison administration or the NIO to the Sunday Times. And I spoke to Father Brian McCreesh at the time, and his account is that they got a phone call to go to the prison. And when they got to the prison, Raymond was in a disoriented state. And Raymond told them that he had asked the medical people where he was, and they told him that you're in Scotland and you haven't eaten. Do you want a glass of milk? And he was Raymond at this stage was a wee bit concerned, and he sent for his family. The family came, and the family asked him this, and he says that they told me I was in Scotland. And then the family says, well, you're in hospital, you're in Long Kesh. And Raymond says, Long Kesh, that's a concentration camp. And then he says, where is my friend Francie? He was referring to Francie Hughes, who had died. And the family says, Francie is dead. And Raymond turned around and says, who killed Francie? And at that stage, the prison officers came in and said to the family, the visit's over. That's it, ended. So there's another side to this which the newspapers at the time didn't carry. And that's why this account here has to be treated with suspicion.
Eamon, the question of... Eamon Malley is here in front of me. The question of the record, people writing for history, the two eyewitnesses whose accounts are there, contradicted by the family. What do you think?
We don't know. We simply don't know.
Not knowable, in other words.
Like Kamika said, these are impossible situations, but you can rest assured there are tapes somewhere.
Tapes?
Yes. I suspect there are tapes of all those conversations. I suspect so. I would be shocked if there aren't tapes of all conversations inside the hospital, the jail, everything at that point in time. But those tapes are in the vaults. I don't know if they'll ever come out. I really don't know. And again, I'm not an historian in that sense, but I would say there's a record somewhere.
The question to Eamon Phoenix and to Danny Morrison, here we have a man who's completely disorientated from a lack of food. I mean, is it possible for all accounts of this to be reconciled in some way? Or, Danny, are you seeing it all as black propaganda?
Well, I mean, later the same claim was made about Kieran Docherty, that he had asked for milk. And when his family came in there, Kieran was saying that his position was that he was remaining on the hunger strike until they got their five demands. So there was, of course, a propaganda battle going on, and the British were putting out material all of the time about the hunger strikers, about their families. And in this case here, Mrs. McCreesh has now passed away and is in no position to defend herself. It is disgraceful to depict a mother in this light, which is nothing but callous, and I don't believe for a second that the people involved had that attitude or expressed those sentiments.
The other thing, Pat, I remember the hunger striker who died more quickly than anybody else. Martin Hurston. He died at 46, after 46 days. Now, his death, the doctor who was in the prison at the time spoke to me in great detail about that, and about he spoke of the agonizing convulsions which he witnessed, etc., etc. Now, I happened to be in the desert in Ethiopia in 84, and I saw a female deprived of food, and I saw the people had to physically get on top of her. She had the capacity almost of elevating because of hunger and lack of vitamins, etc., etc. So, you know, the condition of mind of these people when they got past this stage. Martin Hirschen died after 46 days. So whether any of these people would have the capacity 4 or 5 days before death to take a responsible decision to say we want to do ABC, I'm not even sure, Pat.
Let's move on to the events of the weekend from July the 4th to July the 6th, 1981. Again, Eamon Phoenix, in the documents, these are the source of disagreement.
Yes, indeed they are. And I mean, obviously one of the key eyewitnesses and people involved is Danny Morrison, because he was the man allowed into the prison that long weekend. In fact, on Sunday, I think the 5th of July, 1981. We can see the British are under massive pressure internationally. I mean, they are now convinced this may go on endlessly and damage their relations. I mean, there are reports, for example, of British embassy staff in Washington being jeered in the streets and people shouting murderers at them in the diplomatic bag going back to London. So that gives you an example of the incensed attitude towards Britain, particularly in Irish America at that time, the involvement of Senator Edward Kennedy and his colleagues and others. Ramsay Clark arrives in Belfast to see if these prisoners are conscious. So that's the context. And certainly, I mean, there's no doubt that elements in the British establishment, particularly in the Foreign Office, wanted to cut a deal before anyone else died. It wasn't rocket science. The main elements had been there from the previous hunger strike. There was a sense of betrayal by Republican prisoners who thought they'd obtained those in December previously. And so it was all about wearing your own clothes, the right to sort of do non-prison work and so on. So that was the context. And as I say, that long weekend we have these comms coming back and forth between Brendan Duddy, who seems to be in Derry or Donegal, as the provisional leadership assemble. He's telling them provisionals are gathering, Martin McGuinness is here, Gerry Adams is here, and all of that's going on. The British are aware of that. And they are working on the five kind of demands of the prisoners. Now, the key document, I think, is Margaret Thatcher's decision to minimise those demands in her own hand. I mean, she actually intervenes, and in her own handwriting, she strikes things out, she writes things down, and basically she says the prison authorities must manage the regime in the prisons, reflecting the views of Alison and Atkins. Now, Danny obviously can speak for himself. He's in the prison at that time. But there is a very cryptic end to all of this when, in the early hours of the 6th of June, it's a Monday morning, just after midnight, Thatcher authorizes a final message to be sent to the provisional leadership. And there the file ends. We assume that has been sent, but I understand from Danny Morrison it never actually reached him.
No, it was never sent to us, and I don't know whether it was actually sent to Brendan Duddy, but we were never given that reply to the initial statement. And just to explain to the listeners, Pat, I went into the jail on Sunday. It was a day when there's no normal visits. I used the prison officer's entrance. I've described the demeanour of the prison officers when I was going in. I was allowed to meet the hunger strikers. Martin Herson, who you referred to earlier, Martin was in no state to come into the meeting, but five of the six hunger strikers who were subsequently to die were at that meeting, including Joe McDonald, who had gone blind and had 3 days to live and was in a wheelchair. And Joe and I grew up together in Andersonstown and had been interned together. So I explained to them that the British had contacted us, that it was a sign of hope, that it was unclear what they were proposing, because the only thing that I could tell them was what Brendan Duddy was telling Martin McGuinness. And he said that they were prepared to give home clothes, and they were talking about a resumption of normal prisons, or sorry, letters, visits and parcels when the hunger strike ended. And the position of the prisoners was that, first of all, that's not what they were on hunger strike for. They wanted more than that, because one of the great symbols of criminalisation was penal work. I mean, they wanted, whenever they withdrew political status, they wanted the prisoners to wear a uniform, to go by a prison number. They wanted them to carry out whatever orders the prison officers ordered them to do, whatever work. Now, you have to understand that the bulk of the prison administration and the prison officers were, a lot of them were ex-servicemen. Most of them, majority of them, were drawn from the unionist community. And it was a very hostile relationship between the prisoners and the prison officers. So that's what the prisoners wanted. They wanted some mechanism for whatever eventually emerged over those few days, a method that the British would stand over it. And parallel with that, the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace, unknown, they did not know that we were in contact with the British. They were dealing with Michael Allison, and they were pressing for the same type of things.
Now, there is a disagreement between yourself and one of the prisoners, Richard O'Rourke, who says that it was his clear understanding there was an offer on the table, which they wanted as the prisoners to accept.
Okay, well, let me put that into context. When I visit the hunger strikers and tell them what I've just told you, I was not allowed to meet Brendan McFarlane, the commanding officer of the prisoners, along with the hunger strikers. So I met Brendan separately, and I told Brendan what I have just told you, and which is actually confirmed in the phone calls between Brendan Duddy and London. What was said in there at that stage, that was my knowledge, my level of knowledge, and I told him that.
Now, according to Richard O'Rourke, to get quickly to it, he says that this message that you gave to Brendan McFarlane, they discussed it and they accepted it, but that Gerry Adams overruled the wishes of the prisoners in this regard.
And this is the difficulty that Richard now has, because in his book he spends 4 pages describing this offer stroke, what he says was a deal that I brought in. And the problem that he now has is this, that the papers show that when I'm in the jail, and this is in black and white, written in the British handwriting, when I'm in the jail, they state, Duddy says, Martin McGuinness has arrived, they want to know what yous are going to do, what your position is. And the London says in the papers, we're not prepared to put anything down on paper and send it to ministers until we hear the provisionals' views. And Duddy says, we will be in a better position when Morrison comes out of the jail tonight. Now, at that stage, the British hadn't formulated what they were going to offer. Now, Brenton McFarland disputes Richard O'Rourke's version, and Lawrence McKeown, who was in the prison hospital on hunger strike and who was one who survived, also disputes it. Not only that, it isn't until 11:30, 24 hours later, that the first offer from the British arrives, and Eamon Phoenix has described there how it was edited in Thatcher's own handwriting. And if you compare what Richard in his book claims I brought in, and he describes it as, I was amazed, they were offering us the substance of our five demands. If you compare that with what the British actually sent, and is on the record as having been sent 24 hours later, there are huge discrepancies.
Eamon Malley and Eamon Phoenix on this.
Yeah, I mean, you see the rupture there within republicanism over precisely what happened at that point in time, but it wasn't the only rupture. The rupture that developed within the Catholic Church was extraordinary on the island of Ireland, but not just on the island of Ireland. The rupture that developed between Cardinal Basil Hume and Cardinal O'Fee. Cardinal O'Fee did not see these men committing suicide. Basil Hume took the very British position that they were committing suicide. But interestingly, when Cardinal O'Fee was going to see Mrs. Thatcher, he went and stayed with Cardinal Basil Hume, the late Cardinal Basil Hume. And Hume coached them on how to handle Thatcher. Cardinal O'Fee told me this. But the rupture was there between the church. Rupture developed within neighbours. Our neighbours, who were Protestants, became very hostile towards me as an individual in South Belfast. They were in our house every single week, but during that period, because I was covering the hunger strikes day and night, on the radio, television, etc., hostility developed. So that's how it was beginning to play out all over the place. The church was splitting, communities were splitting, and of course, what was going on in the streets became very volatile.
Claire Walsh has been on to tell me that Brendan Duddy's archival papers have been deposited in NUI Galway in the library there, so it's a fantastic resource for researchers. Eamon Phoenix, the question of the state papers now, I mean, we've been looking at these and the disagreements, and you cautioned us earlier that sometimes, particularly civil servants, those with that kind of mindset write for history rather than otherwise. So how much the wiser are we?
Well, I think we are the wiser. I mean, I think for the first time books will be written on the hunger strike based on state papers as well as the kind of memoirs and recollections of individuals involved, because it's still kind of living history, contemporary history, really. Many files have been withheld, of course. I mean, a number of files, key files, have been withheld to 2062, certainly in Belfast, and I think that applies in London as well. So it'll be a long time before the full story comes out.
And we're asking, what are they trying to hide?
If ever.
What is there to hide?
Well, sometimes it's quite obvious. It's intelligence received by the security forces. It's people who are rehoused because they provide intelligence. Or named individuals. You have redacted files now to sort of make documents more accessible in the last 10 years, certainly under the British system, and I think under the Irish system as well. Some of the blanking out is carried out as well to give us as much information as possible. Many of these sort of people whose names are blacked out are still living and might be at risk. That is the assumption.
Danny, finally, I should ask you how you look back on all of this period. I mean, we know where we are today with a devolved government and a shared administration, power sharing, all of that. I mean, how do you look back on it? Was it important in the end of the day?
Well, it was probably the worst year of many of our lives. That hunger strike lasted for 7 months. And many friends of mine died in it, and people were killed on the streets and the outside. I still get extremely emotional about that period. I'm intensely proud of the people who participated, and I'm honoured to have known them. I mean, I knew Bobby Sands and knew him for many years while he was in prison, and visited him throughout the whole of 1980. They were extraordinary people. I wished it had not happened. The tragedy is that when the hunger strike was over, and when, in fact, whenever I went back into the H blocks, I was sentenced to 8 years in the 1990s. The prison was ran the way it was whenever I was interned. Republicans looked after the wings, and the prison administration acknowledged the Republican command structure. And then, of course, later, the British government gave the prisoners early release under the Belfast Agreement, acknowledging what everyone knew all along, that they were politically motivated.
So you think worth the sacrifice?
Well, you know, where was it? Plato said that only the dead have seen the end of war. And I'm glad that we're living in a peaceful situation now. I think real progress has been made. I totally disagree with those dissident Republicans a bomb was planted yesterday in a car aimed at killing a person in North Belfast. Totally disagree with them. I think the majority of former political prisoners are firmly behind the peace process and support what is happening.
Eamon Malley.
Pat, there are a lot of people who wouldn't think it was worth the sacrifice. There were prison governors who didn't think, and their families wouldn't think it was worth the sacrifice. Billy McConnell was a senior governor. I was accessed to him. The prison governors felt their point of view wasn't being heard. I accessed him to ITN. He did an interview, and 3 weeks later, he was dead. So there would be a lot of prison staff, prison governors. Now, you opened the programme with Owen Caron, delivering the eulogy oration. Interesting, I remember the great David Capper, who was one of the most celebrated BBC reporters I have ever met. Wonderful man. And he went to the Falklands. He was covering the Falklands within Buenos Aires. And I remember he said, when he arrived at the airport, somebody said to him, "Bobby Sands, Bobby Sands." So the name of Bobby Sands had resonated throughout the globe.
Eamon Malley, thank you very much for joining us in Dublin. And thank you to Danny Morrison and to Eamon Phoenix in Belfast. We'll have news up after this.